Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
It's Thursday, but I still need some music. Now, not just any music. I need something, I don't know, a little funky. Something with a beat. A beat. No, maybe a beat and a cowbell. No, better yet, ditch the beat, give me a cowbell, and maybe a hand clap. That's what I'm looking for, Alvin. Do you have anything like that lying around? That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm talking about. Come on, y'all. Let's play ball. You know what that is, don't you? That is the Nationals' official victory song. It is, officially. And that's why I'm playing that right now, because the Nats did it again. 12-3, they take a 2-0 series lead. And again, I hate to say I told you so, but I told you so. These dudes are tough as hell. Where are all the dopes who made the Astros the, quote, heavy favorites in this series? And that's not armchair quarterbacking on my part either. I said before the series, the Astros should be favored. They won 107 games. They were the best team in baseball. They should be favored. But I made a point of saying there's no way they should be heavy favorites. And if you think that, either you know nothing about baseball or you know nothing about the Nats or you had not seen them play. Because they went on a nearly unprecedented run after starting the season 19-31. I mean, a point that's been beaten into the ground. But they have been almost unstoppable since then, and they played their best when it mattered most. And now they've tied a record by winning 8 straight postseason games. At this point, you've got a better chance of getting that dopey song out of your head than you do getting them out of a series. Give it to me again, Alvin. You got a cowbell. You got a clap. Yeah, good luck getting that out of your head. But they jumped out to a 2-0 lead in the top of the first, because that's what they do. And at that point, a stunned Minute Maid Park looked on in silence until my man, my guy, Alex Bregman, brought them back to life with a man on in the bottom half of the inning.
And that's hit well and hit deep to left. Off the community leader signs. A 2-run home run for Bregman. And the Astros and Nationals are tied at 2.
Astros radio. And at that point, if you were an Astros fan, you had to be feeling pretty good. The bats have been very quiet, especially with runners in scoring position. But you had the potential AL MVP, who just went yard. The stadium was shaking once again, and the Astros seemed to have their mojo and their swagger back. And I'm talking about the real Astros, the ones with great pitching, rock-solid defense, an offense that just produces, and that team was back. But it wasn't, right? Because just like Max Scherzer the night before, Steven Strasburg might have been on the rocks early on, but he quickly shook that off. Locked in, and was filthy as he ever was. And then as each inning went by, that yard got tighter and tighter. Houston fans were gripping harder and harder, and with good reason. The Nats are damn good, way better than anybody imagined, probably even the Astros themselves. Hell yes, Astros fans were worried. But even in the worst of times, there is no way they could have imagined what was going to happen next. Top of the seventh, 36-year-old Kurt Suzuki leads off the inning. He takes a ball inside, and then he murders a ball.
Swinging a long drive, left field. He's got one now. Kurt Suzuki gives the Nationals the lead. That one above the Crawford boxes. Kurt Suzuki's first career postseason home run, and the Nationals lead the Astros 3-2 here in the seventh inning.
Uh-oh! Nats radio. When Kurt Suzuki starts a home run trot out of the box, you know you get a problem. The guy came into last night's game with one hit in the month of October. He said it himself afterwards. He doesn't even remember the last time he ran into one.
Man, I can't remember the last time I barreled a ball up like that. It felt great. It felt like months ago. So probably was months ago. So it felt great. I think it was just...
Yeah, I bet it did. Man, this guy is a pro, though. He's come up huge time and time again. Behind the plate for the Nationals, but he's not in the lineup for his bat, not in the postseason, except for some really weird reason. I mean, guys that you never expect to show up do show up in the postseason, but for some really bizarre reason, he's like this Justin Verlander killer. Always has been, and he was again last night. Then you have Victor Robles, who walks on 7 pitches. So, if Kurt Suzuki getting the best contact in months is a freaky thing, so is Victor Robles walking. My man's not exactly Barry Bonds or Ricky Henderson when it comes to drawing walks. He just doesn't. So Verlander leaves the game, and then all hell breaks loose. I'd say the floodgates opened up at that point, but a flood does not begin to describe that ensuing natural disaster. Trey Turner, who's got to scare the hell out of you if you're an Astro fan, walks. Adam Eaton lays down a perfect sack bunt. That moves the runners over. An actual sack bunt, something else you rarely see in baseball now. Anthony Rendon flies out. George Springer comes up throwing. Robles stays at third base. And then yet another thing that you never expect to see happen happens. The Astros give out an intentional walk to Juan Soto. They never give out intentional walks. And that's not even a figure of speech. I mean, they never give out intentional walks. That's the first intentional walk A.J. Hinch has issued all year long. A.J. wants you to earn every 90 feet. So the fact that he did that for Soto is the ultimate sign of respect. They were the first team since 1955 to go an entire season without intentionally walking a batter. But they did so to Soto. That's how much they respect that stud. I mean, how much would you have to respect a guy to intentionally walk him to load the bases to get to Howie Kendrick? That's how scary package-grabbing Soto is right now. But here we are.
Here the bleep we are.
At least there were 2 outs. I repeat, 2 outs. Because when you're facing the Nats, that's either the best thing or the worst thing. You're either just about to get out of the inning, or you're never going to get out of the inning. And last night, it was the latter. Go ahead and roll it.
Here's the next pitch. Swinging a ground ball left side. It's off the glove of Bregman. He hurries and can't pick it up. All hands are safe and a run will score. Bregman to his left, boots the ball, couldn't pick it up. Robles crosses the plate, and the Nationals add to their lead. It's 4-2.
Not exactly a rocket off of Kendrick's bat, but that was enough. 4-2. Then Cabrera comes up.
Swinging a line drive, base hit center field. Turner will score. Soto the plate, and he will score. As Drubal Cabrera drives home 2, the Nationals have scored 4 in the top of the 7th. They lead Houston 6-2 here at Minute Maid Park.
6-2 Nats, followed up by a wild pitch. Now the Astros are teetering on the brink. They're desperate to get out, get another out, like a fighter hoping that the bell is going to ring so they can just get back to their corner. Of course, this was a case where they were waiting for the bell and may have been out on their feet and walking back to the wrong corner. But not dead, can't quit. Not dead, can't quit. A 2-run deficit's bad, but not that bad. But the way they're hitting, a 4-run deficit's trouble. Anything else is a disaster. And then that's what this became, an unmitigated disaster.
3-2 to Zimmerman. Swinging a chopper third base side. Tough chance coming in. Bregman bare hands the ball to throw to first. Throws it away. Here comes the second run. He'll score. Zimmerman goes to second. Nobody there. And the throw is not in time with Cabrera scoring behind Kendrick.
Man, 8-2 Nats. The meltdown was on. A complete implosion. And it's not even like they were strafing it. That was no laser show by the Nats. In fact, that was the very definition of soft contact, but enough to cause problems. Serious problems for the Astros, who had no answers at the plate, all the wrong answers in the field, and that's why Davey Martinez is constantly harping on his guys, put the ball in play, put it in play, make them make a play. Well, that's why. Because that's what can happen, even to a team as good as the Astros. Meanwhile, the Nats are partying like crazy. That dugout was the hottest club in all of Houston. That franchise has gone from a collection of chokers to a collection of killers. Killers rocking crazy sunglasses, giving out group hugs to Steven Strasburg, throwing dugout dance parties when guys homer. And by the way, on that topic, dugout celebrations are an idea whose time has come. And these guys have perfected it, and they're getting a lot of practice. Man, they got it all. Clapping, stomping, guys drumming on Gatorade jugs. Did you check out Adam Eaton's sprint? around the bases after his home run in the eighth.
Last time up, laid down a sacrifice bunt to the six-run seventh. And swings and drives one to deep right toward the line. Way back. It is gone. Goodbye. A line shot. Two-run home run for Adam Eaton, speeding around the bases. Just to slow down, he's going to catch Victor Robles to the plate. Adam Eaton points to the Nationals cheering section. It's a two-run home run for Adam Eaton.
Incredible. Even better than that sprint around the bases. Did you catch him make his way down the dance tunnel, in the dugout, and then sit down next to Kendrick to rev the engine? Look, I don't care how much you love the Astros. I don't care how much you hate the Nats. I don't care if you don't give a damn about any of this. You can't tell me that celebration wasn't awesome, especially the way Eaton and Kendrick finished it. I mean, damn, this crew is all gas and no break. They just went on the road in the World Series, and they beat Gerrit Cole in Game 1 and Justin Verlander in Game 2, and they didn't grind out Game 2. They dominated Game 2. That was a beatdown, the kind of a game that's going to leave scars on the opponent. And now they're going back home with a 2-0 series lead and playing three games. Time to fire up that victory song one more time. I got to get out right now, but damn, they are so impressive. So impressive.
Come on, y'all.
More thoughts on that. As far as the Astros, not dead, can't quit. Not impossible. Teams have come back from down 2-0. Teams have even come back from down 2-0 after losing 2 in a row at home. Not dead, can't quit. Not impossible, but not likely. Steve Smith Sr. is my guest. Steve, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you, Jim?
Good, man. Great. Super. Listen, lots of things to talk to you about involving football and life, but first, you're part of the coverage of the Washington-Minnesota game tonight, Steve, so let me start right there. Kirk Cousins has thrown for more than 300 yards in each of his last three games. How does he look to you right now, and what's different?
Well, I mean, that's a lot to unpack, but I think really ultimately it goes down to the pass coordinator or the offensive consultant they have on staff with Gary Kubiak. What he does, how he does it, is very methodical in how he wants to establish the run. You look at a Mike Zimmer, what has transpired is as he has been a head coach and all the different coordinators, right? And so a lot of defensive-minded coaches look at their defense as their strength, offense, don't screw it up. But when you have a quarterback like Kirk Cousins who really needs everything to be perfect for him, and that's not a knock on him, that's just his preference and how he does his business, you have to accommodate that. And running the football gives him a clean pocket, which makes it picture perfect. So when they do play action, you have guys like Diggs, Adam Thielen, like last week, running wide open where he can't miss the guy because it's clear as day. And some people look at Kurt as a game manager. Listen, no matter what you're paying a guy, whether he's a rookie or a veteran, your quarterback is the CFO of your team, of your organization. He touches the football every single play. And all these cameras we have at the game, what do they focus on? The football. And Kurt touches it every single play. So you need a guy who feels comfortable and is going to do the right things and make the right choices. So you got to set him up for success.
Steve Smith joining us. So, Steve, bottom line this for me. When you look at that defense and you look at Dalvin Cook and you look at those wide receivers, it seems like they've got all the pieces in place to make a Super Bowl run. Do they? Or more importantly, do they have the quarterback who can lead them there?
Well, let's pump the brakes on the Super Bowl run and let's try to get out of the regular season first. And, you know, I hate to say it, but also Kubiak's style of offense, you're going to have a certain amount of games, 3 or 4 games, where they're just going to lay an egg. That's how this offense is. That's what happens. You go back to Gary Kubiak, Kyle Shanahan, Mike Shanahan, all these guys at some point in the game plan throughout the season is going to lay an egg. The last time Kyle Shanahan laid an egg in a big game, Super Bowl. With the New England Patriots, and he was offense coordinator for the Atlanta Falcons. So that's what's going to happen. So if they can continue to gain momentum and establish some good habits and continue to be a little bit unpredictable, that is going to help their success. If you become predictable, it's not going to work out.
Talking to Steve Smith. Now, the Redskins, Steve, have been pretty predictable, predictably bad. They're 1-6. Their only win came against Miami. They've got an interim head coach. They just got shut out at home. What kind of a team are you expecting to show up tonight in Minnesota?
Well, I can tell you this. I don't believe playing Dwayne Haskins is the best choice right now just because that offensive line is not very good. Trent Williams is refusing to go there, and I don't blame them based off what has happened. I think they need to go ahead and part ways. He doesn't want to be there. They obviously are not operating in the best interest of the Washington Redskins of allowing their players to get the adequate medical care. Alex Smith gets hurt, 17 surgeries. I mean, they have a history there with the medical situations where it would say, hey, I don't blame you, Trent Williams. But then also, too, this is a team that, I hate to say it, they couldn't even score no points. I mean, they were awful in the rain. So you put them indoors and you're expecting something different. This is a team that is in transition. Their management isn't doing very good. The plays on the field, the coaches. This is a team that is in a rebuilding stage, and they need to rebuild, and they need to figure it out fast.
We're talking to Steve Smith, Sr. All right, Steve, you were recently part of a wide receiver roundtable, which included Jerry Rice, Steve Largent, and Michael Irvin. I'm curious, what was that like for you? And then when you consider you guys all had different styles and different approaches, mm-hmm. but is there something that all of you had in common?
I mean, other than we all play wide receiver, honestly, I really felt disqualified. Sitting at that table, I had questions. I asked questions off the air that we never air. We won't air that. It was just remarkable. I see Steve Largent, you know, obviously Michael Irvin, Jerry Rice. It was just an unbelievable event to be a part of, and it was surreal. You know, it's one thing to play in the league, but it's also another to be part of a process in which you don't really think you deserve to be in. And so you get to be, I kind of feel like I was a fly on the wall. So that was really cool. I mean, I love being a part of it. And I love talking to those guys and seeing them and just picking their brains and hearing the stories from those guys was pretty remarkable.
We're talking to Steve Smith. And then earlier this month, Steve, you were inducted into the Carolina Panthers Hall of Fame. I mean, that's quite an honor. That's quite a tip of the hat to you. What was your reaction when you received the news first?
Very, very surprising. David Tepper's done a really good job of just changing things up there in Carolina, and he's been very diligent in how he goes about it. He does a lot of things behind the scenes, so it was a pretty remarkable event weekend for the inductees. But one of the coolest things is for our families. One of a cool story is, you know, I'm Steve Smith Sr., but Steve Smith Jr., you know, when I was in Baltimore, he was such a young infant, you know, he's a baby, and now he's 5 years old, and everything's starting to register. And we're on there, and he's saying, do they all know that I'm Steve Smith as well?
And he's
walking around like, Dad, I'm your biggest fan. And he's just kind of repeating some of the things that he was hearing at the events. And it was really cool. And my oldest had just told me that it was great for him because he really got to see the impact that I've had on the team. And he was part of some of the events with me. So it was really good for my family. And we really enjoyed that aspect of not honoring me, but honoring us. So that was pretty cool.
Steve Smith Sr. joining me for another moment or so. You know, when David Tepper reached out to you about that honor, he called you the best player the Panthers ever had. I know how much that honor means to you. I know how much pride you take in the career you had. But you corrected him and said, quote, second best player. Sam Mills is the first. Steve, for those who do not know, what was it about Sam that made him so unique and so special?
Well, besides through his diagnosis and through his whole battle with cancer, he coached guys as if nothing was going on. But I think the biggest impact on me is my rookie year, you know, I couldn't really get on the field much at wide receiver. And I was bogged down with servicing the defense. And at times my quarterback was Jim Harbaugh. And so are we out there and doing it. And also Tim Hasselbeck was my quarterback, too, in that year. And Sam, one day at practice, he says, listen, I don't know why you're not playing wide receiver, but you keep doing what you're doing, and eventually you'll get there. Now, for a linebacker's coach who doesn't – he didn't have to say that, but he went out of his way, sought me out after practice, jogged up to me. First of all, I'm like, well, why is Sam calling me? What did I do? And he just patted me on the back and gave me encouragement. Usually that doesn't happen a lot. He doesn't even have to notice me, but he noticed me. And that just said things to me. And he always has something encouraging or a pointer to point out. Again, he was a linebacker coach. He was not a wide receivers coach. He wasn't a tight ends coach. He was on the opposite side of the field, but yet he was still paying attention to me. That's a standard in which, you know, a lot of people don't really carry themselves by, and that's just one of the many things from little old me that other people have said, as well as all the great Sam Mills stories, that just those great moments that he would always share and build into people.
Steve, one more moment, one more great moment. You were in the locker room when he was in that fierce fight with cancer, and he gave the now legendary keep pounding speech before the playoff game against Dallas. What do you remember about Sam physically at that time, and what do you remember about that speech?
What I remember about that speech is really just trying to get a guy to say, look, you got to pull it from something, somewhere bigger, somewhere more, somewhere deeper, and understand that we're all fighting. We're all going to be fighting against something, and his happened to be cancer. But one of the other things that a lot of people don't know and it's tied to, the morning Sam Mills died, August 18, 2005, is the exact same morning that my 14-year-old son, Boston, was born. So those guys will be ever forever linked, as I call some friends to tell me about a new family of the Carolina Panthers. I was receiving a call that one of our family members in the Carolina Panthers had passed away. And so that was really meaningful and always something that every year around Boston's birthday that I think about. And I link those two men together. And I've told him now, he's older, I told my son of the morning that he was born and the impact a guy like Sam Mills had on my life. And I hope my son Boston can not be like his dad, but have an impact the way Sam Mills had on young men as well.
Steve Smith Sr., NFL Network analyst, a five-time Pro Bowl player. And remember, you can see him tonight on NFL Game Day kickoff at 6 p.m. Eastern. Thursday Night Football continues tonight. You've got Washington and Minnesota on Fox, NFL Network, and Amazon Prime Video. Steve, you know I appreciate you. Thank you so much. Great to have you on the show, Steve.
Appreciate you.
But I want to skip ahead to this because there's a team that I want to discuss, and that's the New York Knicks. And the reason I bring this up is I have an NBA rundown, but I'm not sure that I can put them in that rundown. I'm not even sure they're an NBA team at this point. I mean, sure, they played last night, sort of. I mean, they did score 15 points in the first quarter against the Spurs. So I guess on some level that means they played. Kind of counts, right? Now, the reason they're not getting more attention as a team, yet they're getting their own take right now, is what they did not on the floor, but what they did off the floor. And that generally is the case with the Knicks. They almost always get run for what they do now off the floor. The product on the floor is like the 50th thing that comes to mind when you think about the Knicks on any given day. And when you finally do get around to that, it's never a good thing. But no, this take right here is not about the product on the floor. Not even about the fact that they had 15 points in the first quarter. No, this is about the product in the concession stand. According to reports, the Knicks are going to be serving a Cheetos ice cream sundae this year. Yes, I said it. A Cheetos ice cream sundae. Cheetos ice cream sundae. Like ice cream with Cheetos. The hell is this? The hell is this? The dope who came up with this? Who would do that? And it'd be way too easy and way too convenient to say, oh, I know. I know which dope came up with this.
Wash away my troubles.
Who else could come up with Cheetos ice cream?
With the rain in Shambhala.
I'll be real. I actually kind of like Cheetos. I'll admit it. I like Cheetos. In fact, more than a little. You know, aside from all that fake dye, it's probably the most unhealthy thing in the world. I kind of like them. I don't go out of my way to find them, but if I see them, I'll eat them if they're in front of me. I kind of like them. Just like I kind of like ice cream. In fact, I like ice cream a lot. I mean, I'm not like Ike, but I mean, I like Cheetos. I like ice cream. I just don't like Cheetos in my ice cream. This is not one of those chocolate peanut butter situations. This addition is a full-blown subtraction. Listen, stories about wacky, dangerous, idiotic things that are served at sporting events are so tired and extremely played. Normally, it's just some desperate pub grab by a minor league team somewhere that's just trying to get some run by throwing together a few awful things and then getting every single wacky morning zoo show around the country to talk about them. You know how that goes, right? One person on the show says, hey, you hear about this one? And the next thing you know, the Mud Hens or the Rumble Ponies have gotten themselves a bunch of free pub, bunch of free run, maybe even move some of their merch. And you know what? I can't even tie this one to the doofus who owns that team.
Wash away my troubles. Wash away
I can't even put that on Dolan. It'd be too easy. A move this idiotic can't be all on him. There are way too many other idiots who'd be involved in approving something like that. So it better be a prank, or it better be a PR stunt. And even if it is, it's still so far beneath the Knicks. It's so far beneath a team and an organization that's already at the bottom. These are the New York Knicks.
We are the New York Knicks.
I repeat, the New York Knicks, not the, like, Omaha Storm Chasers or Hartford Yard Goats. I mean, let's be real about this. Let me just put this out there so you can follow. The New York Knicks have always been a wildly overrated, overhyped team and organization. Yeah, I know, Knick fan. That may feel like that's a reason to go, but you know it's not. Because you know it's true. Your quote, unquote, glory days. They're not that glorious. You have two titles to your name. That's one more than the Kings have. That's one less than the Heat have. And the Heat didn't even exist when Pat Ewing was drafted. You haven't won an NBA title since 1973. We're closing in on 50 years without you winning a ring. So the idea that you're some sort of traditional power is a figment of your imagination. It's a joke. It's a lie. It doesn't exist. Now, having said that, the Knicks are extremely overrated. They get way too much credit for having achieved so very little. But despite that, I'm still pissed about this. Again, this better be a joke, or it better be a prank, because if it is real, man, it is a disgrace. You're going to bring a Cheetos sundae into Madison Square Garden, the mecca of basketball. Like, the best part about this team, the best part about this organization is the arena. And now you're going to disgrace that with a Cheetos ice cream sundae. Man, get the hell out of here with that junk. That is minor league. That is so Bush League. And let's not confuse this disaster with other Knick disasters. Like, you want to go out and you want to win 17 games last year while trading a potential franchise player to clear space for two elite free agents, only to watch those two elite free agents sign with the team in Brooklyn? Hey, man, that's fine. You do you. You want to sign Jerome James to a six-year, $30 million deal back in the day? Great. You want to overpay for an aging Allen Houston for sentimental reasons? Be my guest. You want to pay an enormous sum of money to a broken-down Joakim Noah? Your money, your choice. Man, but don't you bring Cheetos ice cream in a sundae in Madison Square Garden. You're the New York Knicks. Not the Augusta Green Jackets or the Bowling Green Hot Rods. Man, act like it. You're the Knicks. Maybe being the Knicks doesn't mean anything to you anymore, but it should. And if it doesn't, at least respect yourselves. And if you're not going to do that, at least respect that house. Respect Madison Square Garden. You don't need stunts at the concession stand to get people into that building. But then again, maybe you do. And if you do, at least have the self-respect not to reach for those stunts. I mean, what's next? Having Tonya Harding serve up that ice cream? Maybe, look, you're the New York Knicks. Maybe that doesn't mean as much in reality as it does in your heads. Man, but get your heads out of your asses. End this charade. You deserve to go 0-82. You deserve to run the table backwards. Sticking Cheetos in an ice cream sundae in Madison Square Garden. Get your heads out of your asses. So embarrassing. Katie's right. The Knicks are not cool. Brooklyn is cool. It's come from a guy who's not going to play a single minute this year. And still much cooler. Bush League. 1-800-636-8686. Let me tell you something. You think John Starks would have let that happen? You think Oak would have let that happen? You think Mace would have let that happen? Anthony Mason, Charles Oakley, John Starks? No way Spree lets that happen. No way Spree lets that happen. Phil Jackson would be dropping all the Cheetos on the ice cream. He'd let that happen. You think Dave DeBuscher would let that happen? Carmelo Anthony might. Hell, it might have been Melo's idea. That might have been Melo's idea. Think Van Gundy would let that happen? Oh, he'd let, yeah, Van Gundy would let that happen. Jeff Van Gundy would definitely let that happen. Think Jerry Lucas would let that happen? You think Walt Hazard would let that happen? Come on, man. You're the Knicks. At least I thought you were. CJ McCollum is my guest. CJ, good to have you back. How are you?
Good, man. Good to be back.
Man, so good to have you back. So good to have you back. All right, so the season started last night. Didn't end with the best result against the Nuggets, but how good did it feel to get back out there, play games that matter, and how hyped are you to get back to face Sacramento tomorrow night and get back at it?
I felt great to get out there and play a real game. It's unfortunate we weren't able to come away with a win in front of our home fans, but it's a long season, so we're looking forward to kind of building and getting used to some of the new guys we have on our roster.
You know, you mentioned some of the new guys. One of the new faces on the team, CJ, is somebody I've got a ton of respect for, Kent Bazemore. He didn't have the best shooting night last night, but he did have five steals. What do you make of how he fits in with the roster and the rest of the crew?
His energy is contagious. He's got great wingspan. He's got great anticipation. And I think he's going to be a great addition to our team going forward, obviously. You'd like to put the ball in the hole, but you know, based on the work ethic and everything I've seen, we're going to be just fine.
Talking to CJ McCollum, you wrote a piece, I thought, for the Players Tribune this week that was really good. And it started with the crowd reaction in Portland to the shot. Now, when I mention the shot, anybody who knows basketball knows what shot I'm talking about, the one from Dame, where, as you wrote, quote, honestly, I thought we were going to start an earthquake, end quote. Take me back to that moment. How amazing was it to be in the center of that?
It was definitely a moment I'll never forget, being able to be on the court and be a part of history. Making it to the conference finals, and the way we did it, with it being a 30-foot walk-off at home in front of all our fans, you could just sense the anticipation. You could sense what it meant to the crowd, the city, and the fact that it was to end a series in the playoffs meant that much more.
So when you have a season like that and you get to the conference finals and then you have moments like the one where you had 41 in triple OT against the Nuggets, 37 on the road in game 7 of that series, how much of that carries over into the offseason? In other words, is there an element that I got a taste of that on the biggest stage in the most pressure-packed moments and now I need more, I want more?
Yeah, I definitely think that getting a taste of that on the biggest stage makes you more hungry, makes you more determined to figure out ways to achieve more success as a team. You know, looking at how we lost to the Warriors, the fact that we were swept, the fact that we were leading games and weren't able to close games out, just kind of shows you that you're right there. You just have to figure out a way to get over the hump. And I think based on our team, our DNA, our culture, and how we go about things, I'm looking forward to seeing how we react to this challenge this upcoming season.
You know, it seems to me like every great athlete wants to measure themselves against the best, obviously, and they want to see how they'll perform on the biggest stage. Like, deep down, did you know that it was just a matter of opportunity, that if you got that shot, you'd come through the way you did on the big stage? Or do you never really know until you're out there?
I think it's just based on a lot of preparation that happens behind closed doors. Success doesn't just happen overnight. There's a lot of small failures that lead up to that one big breakthrough. And I think over the course of my career, I've hit shots and I've missed shots. I've had great games and I've had 5 for 18 games like last night. And it's just more about your mentality and how you respond. You can crumble. You can woe is me and feel sorry for yourself, or you can go back to work and figure out how to overcome it. And I think historically, I've been the type of person that figures out a way to overcome it and doesn't make excuses.
CJ McCollum is joining us once again. So in terms of your experience now, you know what it takes to win in the postseason. In your view, is it about talent and execution, or is it more about something else?
It's a combination of everything. You do need talent, but you need to be able to execute down the stretch. You need players who trust each other. You need a system that the players will buy into and be willing to, you know, sacrifice for. And I think you look at the teams that have won championships, Toronto Raptors, they had a pretty solid DNA, good bench. Obviously a star player in Kawhi, but the DNA of the Warriors, you know, carefree basketball, everybody shares, you know, everybody's happy for each other, they encourage each other, and I think that stuff becomes contagious, and not too often do you see teams win a championship that don't get along and like each other.
CJ McCollum is joining us. So the West has been a grind for years, right? But when you look at some of the moves that the Clippers and the Lakers and the Rockets have made, what kind of thoughts do you have about the West this season?
I think it's going to continue to get better, you know, not just the top, but teams that are finished, you know, 12th, 13th, 11th, they're getting better. The Phoenix Suns, Sacramento Kings are good. They're continuing to figure out how to play together. They got a lot of young talent. I think the entire Western Conference from top to bottom has continued to improve, and that's what makes it so competitive. I think there's going to be a lot of teams in position to potentially make the playoffs and only one or two games separating, you know, the sixth place team from the 10th place team.
All right, now there's no way I can have you on the show and not ask you about your brother, Eric. He had 32 in the Euro Cup this week. He leads the competition in scoring. How proud are you of how he's handling his business over there?
I'm super proud, man. I can't wait to get my visa and I get out there and check him out in Russia. I always say that if I don't make it, it's because things went well during my season. But if he can play till June and get to the Euro Cup championship, I have a shot at making it. Obviously, it would have to be after our parade, after we win the championship. But I'm extremely proud of him, his work ethic, the way he's approached the game. He's the ultimate professional, 10-plus years overseas. Went to a Division II school, Division II NAIA school, and is now the all-time leader in free throws attempted, free throws made in the Euro Cup, and is on pace to lead them to a Euro Cup championship this season.
CJ McCollum is my guest. Now, you and I have talked, and I'm just moving quickly through these things because there's so many things I want to cover with you, but we've talked about your podcast in the past, and you recently told the New York Times that you consider it one of your, quote, healthy habits, that it gives you some escape, something else to do. What do you mean by a healthy habit, though? How does it have that kind of impact for you?
It just gives me a chance to kind of escape basketball, although I'm talking about it, I'm not physically exerting the energy running up and down the court, trying to burn myself out. It allows me to talk about topics I enjoy. It's fun. It doesn't get me in trouble. I'm not going to be on the news for anything crazy as long as I don't, you know, say anything that's too newsworthy. And it allows me to kind of sharpen up my tools as a journalism major. So I think there's a lot of positives with it. That's why I call it a healthy habit, because it's something I enjoy doing. And it gives fans a different side of me.
Now, speaking of healthy habits, over the past year or two, a number of players have talked about mental health. And there could be a perception among fans that you guys make so much money, you're living the dream. What could you possibly stress about? How could you possibly have anxiety? You don't know what real pressure is. I mean, you've heard these things. What is your reaction when you hear that?
My reaction is that everybody has pressure. Everybody has anxiety and stresses. It's all about how you deal with it. And money doesn't solve those problems, as we've seen historically. There's been a lot of people who have been in positions of power, made a lot of money, and unfortunately decided to commit suicide. So I think it's bigger than that. there's a lot of issues at stake that we all deal with personally, and a lot of times you can't tell. A lot of times it's on the inside, and the people that are willing to come out and speak about it, willing to seek help, are the people who are usually successful at turning it around. And I can admit it myself, you know, as a professional athlete, I've seen a lot of guys, including myself, deal with a lot of different problems. Like you said before, you have a lot of money, so a lot of other people's problems become your problems. There's problems to perform. There's stress, and there's that dip that comes when you go through injuries or poor performance. So there's a lot of things that can drive you literally insane in this world. So it's more about how you deal with it and not being afraid to admit that. We all have issues at times. We have to figure out how to cope with them in a positive way, and that's why I try to find healthy habits like meditating, like reaching out to people who can help me, and just trying to take a break from the real world at times.
CJ McCollum joining us. All those things can contribute to all of that. Another part is sleep. Baxter Holmes did this fascinating piece, I thought, about sleep or lack of it in the NBA. So how do you go about approaching sleep and making sure you get as much as possible?
Yeah, I do a pretty good job of getting sleep. I try to get into bed at the same time every day, but obviously as the season starts, it's harder, you know, going from time zone to time zone. The biggest thing for me is eliminating electronics once you get into bed. You know, having a hard stop time on certain Netflix and TV shows that you're watching. And I try to take a nap every day. So if I do those things, I feel pretty good about where I'm at. And I'm normally in the bed 9:30, 10, so I'm getting my 8.5 or 9 hours of sleep every day.
CJ, one of the debates, of course, about the nap is how long is the nap? If you get a nap in every single day, how long is your nap?
It fluctuates, man. I don't think there's a special recipe for it. And this is one of the times where I don't really listen to statistics because everybody's body is different. Sometimes you might need a 90-minute nap. Sometimes you might just need 30. I think it just really depends on what you have to do the rest of the day and how you respond. But there's no book on how to, you know, live your life, so to speak. You have to do what you're most comfortable with, and you have to really figure out how your body responds to certain things. And I think I've done that up to this point.
All right, so like in terms of sleep, if a player does not get enough sleep, what does that do to their recovery and their cognitive performance on the court?
If a player doesn't get enough sleep, for one, there's a higher risk for injury because your body's not able to fully recover. I don't think you're as sharp. I feel like, especially in the fourth quarter, it's probably harder to concentrate. And just the overall health, wellness, and performance, sleep is everything. No matter how much you train, no matter how much you take advantage of the resources around you, if you don't sleep, that's the ultimate recovery that you're missing out on.
CJ, it seems to me like, never mind if guys are on the road, like back in the day, if guys are getting after it and they're running the streets pretty hard and they're hitting the clubs. I mean, even if you didn't do any of that, if you just played an NBA schedule and you flew time zone to time zone, even if you never went out, it seems to me it'd be pretty tough to get enough sleep.
At times, it's hard to get sleep just because you're going from time zone to time zone. But historically, I mean, I've done a pretty good job. It's just more so your schedule. If you go to sleep at 1 a.m., but you don't have practice until 11, you can still, you know, get a good 9 hours of sleep or 8.5, depending on when your meeting starts. So it's just more about what time your coaches are strategically planning stuff. I think every team has health and performance staff, and their job is to maximize sleep based on city, based on travel, and based on feedback from players. So, I mean, I've been fine in my career going into year 7, having started year 7. And I think it's just more so structure, prioritizing, and figuring out a way to get what you need.
And healthy habits. Like I said, we couldn't cover everything. We didn't talk wine. We didn't talk Browns. But we got a lot of stuff done. CJ McCollum is my guest. He is the host of Pull Up with CJ McCollum. Make sure you listen to that. Portland Trailblazers guard. They're back at it at Sacramento tomorrow. CJ, appreciate you very much, man. Thanks so much.
No problem. Thank you.
Rome, my beef. I can be highly specific. October 28th, 2011, Game 6 of the 2011 World Series, bottom of the ninth, two outs, two strikes, Nelson bleeping Cruz, like a little league right fielder circling a routine fly ball over his head. Why weren't his heels on the warning track? Let the ball fall in front of you, but not over your head. But I don't hold a grudge. Bleep Nelson Cruz. My man's not only got beef, he's got beef going back to 2011. If he's not over that yet, he never will be. Jumpman, I've got a beef. To all the morons who immediately get up as soon as the plane lands and rush to the front. Wait your turn. Steve in the CLE. He's got a beef. How about the phones? These are all email beefs. Let's go to the phones. Dan in Cleveland. Yo, Dan, what's your beef?
Howdy, partner. How you doing, mate?
What's up, partner?
My beef is that the Indians aren't in the World Series, and we all love the Red Sox. Dan and C-Town, self-gloss. Come on.
You don't like that car. I don't like that car. What's your self-gloss? Dan in Cleveland? That's your name, bro. That's not self-glossing. I said Dan in Cleveland. What's up? What's your beef? Dan in Cleveland, self-gloss. Come on. Like, dude, you just threw a bunch of jungle elements together and tossed them up like some weird jungle element word salad, and it didn't work. You didn't self-gloss. Self-gloss is when you take a nickname or a moniker and you give it to yourself. You just gave yourself your own name, which you already had. That's not a beef. 1-800-636-8686. Hey, Jim, my beef is with the Seattle Mariners. Just quit already. Move to Portland, disband, relegate to the minors. I don't care. Just go away already. All the good players and managers we have ever had are gone already, and they only went to the playoffs 4 times. Get out of here with that garbage. Mike in Ferndale.
Garbage.
Let's try another beef on the phones. Omaha, Nebraska. Kathleen. Kathleen, what's your beef?
With the San Francisco Giants, when they attempted to pay Bryce Harper instead of focusing on paying Madison Bumgarner. Of course, they fail, but how could they forget about the man who's done it all for them over someone who basically failed when the one time he got there and he failed in Philadelphia? Pay Madison, forget Bryce Harper, or it doesn't matter, but pay Madison.
Kathleen, you love Mad Bum. That's her beef. What's your beef? We do this on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Here's an email beef. Quote, my beef is with that loser, Dean Spanos. Sell the team and get the hell out of the NFL. You're a freaking embarrassment. Brewer in San Diego. Romy, I have beef with how you ask questions. Regards, Rex Lee.
Yeah. Well, was that a question? Yeah, I think so.
Maybe not a good question, huh, Rex?
No. I'm not putting it down. Yes, I definitely agree with what you've just said.
You know, honestly, when you think about how we treat our guests, you know, aside from one or two things back in the day, have you ever heard me have an exchange like that with a guest? Now, I've got a lot of respect for people who come on the program. People who would take time out of their day to come on this show. It's unpaid. I mean, they get a lot out of it. You should get a lot of exposure if you come on a show that's enormous like this. But I always respect it and appreciate it. But how about that exchange between Rex Lee and I? Have you ever heard me say to a guest, yeah, I guess that's not a very good question, huh, Rex? I mean, I might say that to a clone who shows up a certain way, but an actor?
Yeah.
You guys said to me, is that a question?
Yeah. So,
what's that for arrogant? Is that a question? What's your name again? Jim Rome, Rex. Is that a question? Yeah, I guess not a very good one, huh, Rex?
Yeah.
Wow.
Was that a question? Yeah.
I remember the showrunner for Entourage. It got back to me that the showrunner at that point said, hey, man, not cool. Not cool. Rome is an enormous fan of our show and what we do and talks us up and was one of the early adopters. Dude, not cool. And it wasn't. Yeah. I got a beef with that guy showing up on this show like that and hit me like that. That's my beef. But he did keep the Rex streak alive, so I can overlook it. Van Smack, what's my beef? My beef is with you letting a Prometheus in the XR4TI. Oh, and that ancient being can't even work in the first row? Seems like his species' technological advancements should at least allow him to produce the show or run the board. JR in DC. War Prometheus's head still being smaller than Lyle Brandt's.
It's lit!
It's Rit!
It's lit!
He got Steven Jackson. He's booking his ass off on the pod. He looks like Dwight Eisenhower. It's Rit!
It's lit!
It's the bird! Wah, wah, wah. Hey, Rome. What's my beef? My beef is my pig nose. Regards, Austin Matthews. Mitch from Buffalo. Hey, Rome, what's my beef? My beef is getting stuck behind coupon lady in the supermarket. The lady who has a coupon for every item in the cart and disputes with the cashier because she did not read the fine print. As the line continues to pile up behind her, that is a world of suck. Mike in Peoria. Man, that's so true. Like, I don't begrudge anybody. It's tough, man. It is hard. It is really hard out there. It's hard out there, and it's hard to make money out there. And you want to get as much value as you can. But it's so true, isn't it? When that person rolls up there and they've got that special little book for their coupons, even that's all right. But it's when they dispute the fine print. Rome, my beef is with Tyler in Edmonton. This guy has been such a letdown to a once great tag team, steadily getting fatter and fatter and fatter and fatter to the point that Team Canada had to ship his inflated ass to Team Florida Man for a conditional seventh round pick. Unwore Tyler wearing construction clothes to nightclubs. Matt in Vancouver, still Team Canada. Sam Ellinger is my guest. Sam, it's really nice to have you on. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good, good, Sam. So I know your attention is already focused or shifted to TCU, but if you could you go back to Saturday's game against Kansas? You got the ball back trailing 48-47, 1:11 left on the clock. A lot of people in that situation might be panicked, might be worried, but from the outside, it seemed like you were extremely calm. What was going through your head at the start of that drive?
I told the guys that we didn't have to do anything different. We had had success offensively all game, and we practice for the situation that we are in. Every Tuesday we have a two-minute drill, and we've been successful on all of those. So I was very calm knowing that I had confidence in my guys and that we were going to go down and score.
You know, actually, just hearing you talk about it right now, you still sound really calm. You're no stranger to being in spots like that, as you've said. You've been doing it since you were a freshman, but you also did say, Sam, quote, maybe on the outside I haven't changed because my freshman year I knew I had to be calm in that moment. Internally, I probably wasn't because I didn't know what the heck I was doing. So let me ask you, how different are you now because of all the experience and the fact that you do know what the heck you're doing?
Completely different, no doubt. Freshman year I was trying to figure out what it took to be successful in college, and then now I have confidence in the offense. Third year, the continuity has been great for me. I'm adjusted to the speed of the game, and I know what it takes to beat different defenses. So the confidence, in turn, provides a calmness inside of me.
Sam Ellinger is my guest. So you avoided a sack on the first play of the drive, and then you complete a pass to Colin Johnson, but it was negated because of a penalty. But then you come right back and you complete a 16-yard pass to him for a first down. A few plays later, you run for 8 yards on a third and six near midfield. Then you hit Johnson for 20, then Johnson for 11. That sets up Cameron Dicker for a 33-yard field goal as time expires. I'm kind of curious, what kind of emotions go through you when he lines up for that kick, and then what's it like when he makes it?
Yeah, I think when he started jogging out there, I went through every emotion possible. At first, I didn't want to watch. I was too nervous, and then I transitioned quickly to confidence in him. And once he lined up, I know he's hit big kicks before last year, and this year he's been extremely efficient as well. So I had a lot of confidence in him, and then once I saw it through, I was extremely happy.
Yeah, Sam, the guys around you talk about your ability to lead, and that's nothing new. As you point out again, as a freshman, you're asked to do a lot of different things. A few years back, Todd Dodge, who coached you at Westlake High School, said, quote, "I see so many kids these days trying to be popular. Sam doesn't really care about being popular. He is, but he doesn't mind leading in a very sometimes emotional way," end quote. I'm always curious about leadership. What's your approach when it comes to being a leader?
That it's a 24/7 job. A lot of people think being a leader and having a leadership role is lonely, but I disagree. I think you should always be in company with someone else, because being a leader is taking others around you where they can't go themselves. And so understanding and having the mindset of focusing on others opposed to yourself and trying to better everyone else around you at all times.
So, Sam, in Saturday's game, you went over 8,000 career yards in total offense. You're third on the career list behind a couple of pretty familiar names in Colt McCoy and Vince Young. Knowing what that school means to you, knowing what that school means to your family, and the fact that you've called Colt your hero, what's it like to see your name up alongside Colt and Vince's?
It's just a blessing. It's unreal, to be honest. Right now, in the moment, I haven't really looked at any of that stuff because I'm so focused on being the best for my teammates as opposed to looking at the big scale, large numbers. But I'm sure in a couple of years, I'll look back and realize how cool all this really is.
We're talking to Sam Ehlinger. You know, if you look at the big picture, I think people who know your story know that Texas football has always been a connecting point for you and your family. You know the history of the program, you know the guys who came before you. What's it mean to you then to be the quarterback at Texas?
It's an amazing opportunity, and it's been a blessing for me and my family. Growing up, this is what I dreamed of doing, being a part of such a rich tradition, obviously a winning tradition at the University of Texas, and watching all the greats play here. So it's unreal for me to be able to be in their position, be a part and represent an institution that means so much to me and my family, and holds a lot of respect around the nation.
Now, see, Sam, the thing is, though, when you came up, the program had been through some hard times. For example, the Longhorns were 24-26 when you were in high school, and your mom said that people tried to talk you out of going there, but you never wavered, and it actually made you more and more determined. Why was that, and then how much did you want to lean into the challenge of leading them back?
Yeah, I would say growing up and being in Austin and being around the University of Texas and the winning tradition, and I was just so accustomed to the winning mindset with class and respect that the University of Texas carries. It was in high school with obviously the season's not going as well as everyone was used to. It was kind of upsetting or didn't feel right for me. And so I wanted to be able to be a part of a team that helped bring back that tradition and bring back that culture to the University of Texas, regardless of what it took.
So then we talk about what the program, what the school means to your family. Your brother Jake is a freshman linebacker this year. In camp, he won a newcomer competition, which meant that he was going to carry the flag when the team ran onto the field. Got to ask, what was it like to run out of the tunnel with him the first time this year?
It was unreal. Growing up with my brother, you know, playing in the backyard countless times, imagining that we were playing for the University of Texas, running out of the tunnel, playing the sport that we love in our hometown. It was a dream come true, and to be able to have him on campus with me, it makes everything 10 times better.
I mean, Sam, what's it like to have him on the team, and what's it say about him that he turned down Ivy League schools so he could walk on at Texas?
It's been unreal just to have him around, having him on the team with me, just everything that we've been through. I always know that I can go to him with whatever, regardless of football. And then just his determination to come here. Obviously, he's an extremely talented athlete, and he had lots of opportunities to go play other places around the country. But he chose to come to Texas because of, obviously, he got into the business school here, which is incredible. And then he wanted to be a part of Texas football because, I mean, that's what we grew up dreaming about. And I'm really glad he made that decision because now we get to be together.
That's great. Sam Ehlinger joining me for a few more moments. And Sam, this is a big Tom Herman house. He and I go back a ways. So if we were to go back to 2017, this is what he said about you. Quote, he's an alpha male. He walks in the room and it's like, whoa, Sam's here. I mean, he's a competitor. I just love that about quarterbacks. End quote. It's really high praise coming from that guy about you. What do you remember about the first time you met Herman?
I remember I came up to his office right after he had been hired. I was currently committed to Texas, and I had known Coach Herman when he was at Houston because he recruited me there, but I didn't ever get the chance to sit down and talk to him. And then once I came up to the facility after he'd been hired and got to sit down and talk to him, I was really impressed with the intellect that he shows and every conversation that he has, the confidence. And I knew that he was the guy that was going to instill a culture, a winning culture, and continue to put wins up for the University of Texas.
You know, one thing he says, or another thing he says that he loves about you is the fact that you suffered a meniscus injury as a senior in high school. And a lot of guys in your spot, knowing that you were going to enroll early at Texas, would have shut it down for the year and then cheered the team on from the stands, but that you didn't do that. How come?
Just my love for my teammates and the game itself. I believe that the relationships that you form through sports, specifically in my case football, it's unlike anything else in life. And I wanted to be out on the field with my teammates to put us in a position to win, to see their happiness. And I decided to do that and play for them as well. And I also love the game of football, and I'd do anything I could to play.
Sam, one last thing. You mentioned this a few moments ago, and it's one of the things that always comes up when people talk about you and people are around you is the fact that you constantly talk about how blessed you are, how blessed you feel. You have faced some incredible challenges, and you've had to do so in a very public way, things that I think that nobody would call a blessing. How are you able to go through what you've been through and still say, I'm blessed?
Just understanding the circumstances and truly understanding life itself from a greater perspective that ultimately the past doesn't matter. Obviously you're going to entail things in your life that are traumatic and extremely hurtful, but worrying about the past and suffering on those things doesn't help anything in the present. And so it took a while for me to be able to realize that, but now that I do, and now that I see what life is, I mean, I'm playing at my dream university in a sport I love with the people that I love in the city I grew up with a couple of minutes away from home. I'm unbelievably blessed.
It's amazing to me that somebody at your age has that perspective when I think that most people never, ever get to that point. He's the quarterback of Texas. Texas is 5-2. They're number 15 in both polls. They've got another big one coming up on Saturday. They're at TCU. Sam Ehlinger, my guest. Sam, so nice to have you on the show. That's a great jungle debut, and I really appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Good night now.